online
at bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is the UK's home of live news and live sport.
5 Live.
Thank you very much. 7 minutes past two. Lots of movie conversations as normal on a Friday and a little bit more than normal. Mark Kermode, good afternoon.
Can I just say that you've got a bigger quiff than I have today? You've got much more of a sort of bristling cockerel thing going on there in your forehead than me.
It's just because I've been sitting here with my hand in my head.
Is it? But I'm feeling a little bit diminished.
Listen, you've got a quiff that's bigger than anybody's, so you have no reason to fear on that
score.
Okay,
I just wanted to make that clear.
Let's bring in Jason Biggs, who made his name, you'll probably remember, in the American Pie series. He's got a new political black comedy out called Guy X. Jason, hello, good afternoon to you, sir.
Hi, good afternoon, how are you?
Okay, thank you. Tell us this intriguing story in Guy X of this soldier mistakenly posted to an Arctic military base. Where does this come from?
Well, it actually comes from a book called No One Thinks of Greenland, written by John Grisimer. And he based his novel on unconfirmed story of soldiers who were terribly wounded after the Korean War and sent to a base in Greenland and not sent home for a variety of reasons, including among them civilian morale, thought it would be bad for morale back in the United States. So he wrote this story fabricated a love story, we adapted it into a screenplay. Well, I didn't. I wasn't part of that process, but made this dark comedy. Saul Metzdein, who directed a Scottish director, did a film called Late Night Shopping a few years back. Directed it, and it's really cool. It's kind of an edgy film. I play the protagonist Rudy Spruance, who's mistakenly sent, as you said, to this base. While he's there, he discovers the secret of the soldiers being kept there, and after the discovery, befriends one of these soldiers and. It's a pretty touching story from that point.
So you're actually Corporal Rudy Spruance.
That's correct.
Although everyone is calling you Martin Peterson.
That's right. Yes.
And why is that?
Well, there's been an administrative mistake. I'm supposed to be in Hawaii. Rudy Spruance is supposed to be sent to Hawaii. Paperwork errors sent him to Greenland. And they believe that he is Martin Peterson, the person, of course, who is in Hawaii. They don't let him go. They don't let him go. He tries to get out of there, but he can't. And finally accepts that he is not going to be able to leave. And in the meantime, meets and falls in love with Irene, played by Natasha McElhone.
Well, you would really.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah,
I met and fell in love with Natasha McElhone.
But the trouble is she's already hitched, isn't she?
Yeah, I know some people see that as trouble, and I guess you're right.
I'm not talking about in real life. I'm talking about in the movie.
Oh no, I'm talking about in real life.
Oh well, both.
That's my problem. I don't care about the character.
Yeah, but in the movie, she's the other half of your boss.
That's correct. Yes, she's with the colonel of the base, played by Jeremy Northam. And so an interesting little love triangle develops. And also there's another love story, I think, which is at the heart of the movie, and that's the relationship with Guy X, the soldier.
Guy X of the title. Right, explain who he is then.
Well, he is one of these soldiers who is being kept at the base and not being sent home. We don't know his name, hence the Guy X moniker. Rudy, develops this really sweet relationship with him and becomes his friend. And in each other, they find humanity, and it's pretty cool.
So presumably, the Guy X of which we speak, he's being kept there at this base because he's been very badly injured by the Vietnam War?
Yes, because he's been injured and because, there's no identification. But then we find, without getting, too into it, I mean, there's, we find that, there's a bit of corruption certainly involved. They could have been sent home. There's a few reasons why they haven't. And, we've just come to learn that, that's sort of the, one of the things we're focusing on is a little bit is military corruption, and sort of what's its real purpose? What is the purpose of this base in peacetime? What's going on there? What is it doing? What does it serve? What is its purpose?
So in the reviews of your movie, you'll have come across the comparisons with, well, first of all, Buffalo Soldiers, more of recent releases, but Catch 22. As well, although that's a difficult comparison to make. I don't know how fair is that to mention Catch 22 and Buffalo Soldiers.
I think it's fair to compare them tonally to each other. I think Catch 22, also MASH, I'd say maybe in a little bit of Dr. Strangelove. You know, this dark comedy. Guy X, it starts off more of the dark comedy, and then it actually takes this tonal shift midway through, kind of an extreme shift, but I think it's pulled off credibly. I believe it is. And
from what? From political?
From it remains political, but it just goes more from sort of the comedy to it just becomes a bit more dramatic. I mean, that's sort of midway through. Once the discovery, once Rudy happens upon this. This ward, this medical ward where these soldiers are being held, it sort of switches gears a little bit.
So we'll be doing some movie conversation, Mark Kermode, already on Overtime, but the movie review is coming up. Jason Biggs is with us, the star of Guy X. You probably saw him in American Pie. Is that one of those? And obviously it was a fantastic gig to get, Jason, but it's going to be referred to time and again. As you try and do other movies, at what stage do you hope people will stop asking you about American Pie?
To be honest, I expect to get it forever. I kind of hope to. I mean, I hope it's not forgotten. It's certainly work that I'm incredibly proud of, and it's done nothing but wonderful things for me. So, and it's never become bothersome. Maybe a little. Tiresome. It's just because it's I get a lot of the same sort of comments and quote unquote jokes told to me. But it's not interfering with anything.
I better not ask you about what those jokes are because I feel that immediately would be into difficult territory.
Sure, it'd probably be difficult. And to tell you the truth, I mean they're not that funny. So they're really not worth sharing. I think the funniest pie joke. Is the one we put on film. Yes. So, I don't know. The rest pale in comparison.
The movie in question, Guy X, which is the one we're talking about, is moved. As I understand it, the book is based just after the Korean War.
That's correct.
But this has been moved so it's just after the Vietnam War.
Right.
Why was that? Was that deliberately to move it away from MASH and comparisons like that?
I didn't think about that, actually. I don't really know the answer to that question. I wasn't involved in that decision. I wasn't involved in the adaptation process. So I guess it's a better question for the filmmakers. I had suspected, actually, that perhaps it's just because the Vietnam War being so much more of a media presence and sort of a, the Korean War is sort of the forgotten war in a way, it's sort of, it doesn't have, the Vietnam War already, with it comes a lot of controversy. So I think this, my assumption was that it just sort of helped out in that sense,
It sounds, from the way you're describing it, is that it certainly treats soldiers compassionately.
Absolutely.
But is it still an anti-war film?
Sure, but it can also be a pro-soldier film at the same time, which I think it is. I suppose it's anti-war. People are going to see it and assume that it is, and not incorrectly. I think the great thing about this film is that it raises a lot of questions, but we don't try to answer them. And that was the intention of the filmmakers, and I think it's pulled off nicely. But yes, it does certainly show the soldiers in a compassionate light. Absolutely.
Let me introduce you to Britain's premier film critic.
He couldn't make it. I'm here instead.
Mark Como is here.
Hello, Mark. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, how are you going?
I'm well, thank
and,
you.
And some thoughts on Guy X. I mean, I suppose the main review's next week.
But, yeah, sure.
But as Guy's here?
Well, without giving away the twists and turns of the plot, I mean, you've mentioned MASH and Catch-22 and the changing of the time from the 50s to the 70s. I think that is important because you do have to make a distance between it and MASH because obviously there are comparisons there. Also, however, because of where it's set, because I mean, this is a co-production and some of it takes some of it is funded hear some of it. One of the producers is Fredrik Thor Fredriksson, who's a sort of very, you know, famous filmmaker in the colder side of the world. And the point about it is that they are in complete isolation, both from the rest of the world physically and also from the rest of the world temporarily. It doesn't really matter which particular conflict it's coming after. It is very specifically one of those... I mean, there is a whole genre of films which goes from Catch-22 and MASH to this and The Ninth Configuration, the Blatty movie, which to take war as a kind of paradigm for the madness of the human condition. And that's it's very much within that. I don't think it's conflict-specific. The other thing which we're very remiss in not mentioning is that Guy X himself is played by Michael Ironside. Now, if, like me, you are a trash maestro who loves, you know, David Cronenberg movies and Paul Verhoeven movies. I mean, Michael Ironside is a god. He is like he's one of those people in America they're referred to as character actors. He's a really, really great screen presence, and he is the sort of the title character in the middle of this. And I think it's important to flag up his involvement as well, because he does bring a real gravitas, and I think he's often overrated. Would you agree, Jason?
Mark, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Excellent.
I mean, seriously, are you looking at my notes? What's going on?
But he really is a presence and a half. And it's very difficult, yep, because his whole part is bedridden. It's conversations between you and him, and he is unable to move because he is severely wounded. And yet he's
got this intensity regardless. And he's, very tender, sweet. I think he's an amazing actor. The guy's incredible. And you're right, I think he is underrated.
Is there any suggestion from the original book, No One Thinks of Greenland, that there actually was a military base where they kept severely injured soldiers because it would have been too embarrassing for morale? I mean, it sounds extraordinary. I imagine it's not based on truth.
It is mentioned in the book. That is something that comes from the book. And what I believe that it was John Grismer, the novelist, I believe I don't know what his sources were, but he got information about this base where they kept the soldiers after the Korean War. Of course, it's going to be that none of it was confirmed by the U.S. military, nor will it ever be, but that's sort of one of the suspicions, I guess, that he based his novel around.
Mm. You've worked with some pretty interesting directors in your time. I'm thinking particularly of Woody Allen and Kevin Smith. Can you compare and contrast?
The two of them with each other?
Yeah.
Sure. They're actually kind of similar. They're both screenwriter directors, and they both work. They really like their actors. They really work well with actors. In terms of subject matter, I think they're similar as well. Just kind of, sort of dialogue-driven relationship comedies, which is great for me because I love that world both as a fan and as a performer. Kevin, of course, has gone to sort of a broader place. But actually, as I say that right now, you think about some of Woody's movies and some of the departures that he's made. I mean, the guy's all over the map with his themes, and he's done a musical here and he's done everything, right?
The interesting thing about Woody Allen now, though, is that you never know going in, what kind of movie it's going to be, because there is so little publicity in advance, and things are only ever called Woody Allen's untitled Fall 2004 project. And the other thing is that he can hit or miss with equal dexterity. I mean, he can either be right on the nose or he can miss by a million miles.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because I think that in recent years he's had a real great critical comeback. Suddenly people have started taking him very, very seriously again. But there is that fantastic randomness that you have no idea which way Woody Allen... I mean, the most recent Woody Allen film, which I don't want to give away the twist of, halfway through turns into a whole other film. It's not even a comedy.
Is this Match Point?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Which is really peculiar.
Wow. You really never know what you're going to get. Hell, I didn't know what I was going to get on set.
And you only get to read the scenes that you're in. Is that right? So you don't know about the rest of the movie.
That is correct. And to that end, I had the luxury of reading the whole script because I was in every scene, mm-hmm, actually. And so it was actually kind of funny being on set sometimes and have other actors come up to me and ask me to fill them in what was happening before that scene and after that scene. It was pretty wild.
What else are you working on, Jason? Once Guy X has been and gone?
I just completed a film called Antarctica, this Disney family action-adventure film, which was a little change of pace for me, at least in terms of genre.
A Disney family action adventure scene. So once you've made it across the bridge and you've snatched the treasure, do you make it back across and win the girl?
I would if I was the hero protagonist, which I am not. I am instead the supporting comic relief, which was great fun. So it's cool. It's great. My niece and nephews can finally see a movie that I'm in. So the family is.
You mean they haven't seen any of the American Pie movies?
Fortunately, no. Fortunately, no. My sister would kill me if I let them watch it. So
we're going to do our movie reviews in just a second. What we do first of all is do the box office top 10, wherein Mark gives pithy what are supposed to be one phrase reviews, but usually end up as paragraph. While you're with us, you don't fancy being a counterbalance to that, do you, Jason? So I mean, all that happens is I mention a movie and you say what you think of it. Is that unfair?
Sure. No, it's not unfair at all. I might not be educated on all of the films.
Okay, well, if you haven't seen it, just make it up. Okay.
Fair enough. Brilliant.
So this is box office top 10 in this country at the moment. Number 10, The Rising.
Interesting, if not wholly successful, cross-cultural Bollywood epic.
Jason.
I agree.
He's making it up.
Okay. You said make it up.
Okay,
listen.
Absolutely. 9, The Perfect Catch.
Well, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's very, very much Farrelly Brothers light, but the amazing thing about it is that it is absolutely not Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch, upon which it is based. I mean, Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch is a story set in North London about, you know, a guy being an Arsenal fan. This is set in America, starring Drew Barrymore, and about some weird game in which somebody swings a piece of wood and hits a ball. I mean, it's a very, very strange thing. It's perfectly fine, but it's just very odd.
Seen The Perfect Catch, Jason?
I agree. No, okay. Right. I have not, actually. No, I haven't.
Read the book? Have you read Fever Pitch?
I did not read the book. You know, it's funny. It's called Fever Pitch. The movie, the adaptation is called Fever Pitch. I wonder why. And if it's the Nick Hornby novel, of course, is called Fever Pitch.
Well, presumably it's because there is already a British movie version of Fever Pitch.
Because it's football, right? That was the liberty that they took, right? Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Okay, right. Not many excuses on this one. Number 8, War of the Worlds.
You know, I liked it. I thought it was Spielberg's best movie in a very long time, and I think he's much better when he's doing big action summer blockbusters with a very dark edge than when he's, you know, showing off about how intelligent he is. I liked it.
Jason.
This time I really do agree. I can say that with I saw it. I liked it a lot. I thought the effects were fantastic. After each scene, I was on the edge of my seat. There you go.
And the clear moral at the end is, if you live in a wealthy suburb, then your entire family will survive.
Yes.
Yep.
At 7, Wedding
That's
Crashers.
True, isn't it? Well, the Wedding Crashers starts out fine, but it doesn't have the strength of its convictions, because halfway through, it starts out as a bozo, you know, kind of sub-Porky's American Pie-style movie, which I rather enjoy, and then halfway through it suddenly decides that the characters need to grow up, at which point I completely lost interest.
Jason.
Laughed my butt off. Isla Fisher is a great find.
Fantastic Four at number 6.
You know, after the fantastic darkness of Batman Begins, why do I have to sit there and watch smiley, jolly, you know, colourful characters on this? And a serious question, if we are really selling this to kids, why is it that the only female character that the girls have to look up to has to be so spectacularly pulchritudinous and run around in her underwear? I mean, it's like saying, hey, it's fine for guys to look like, you know, Mount Rushmore, but it's not okay for women.
If you can try and avoid pulchritudinous in this next bit, Jason, did you see Fantastic Four?
I did not, no.
Okay.
You and a lot of others didn't. Yeah,
can there be any more superhero movies coming out of Hollywood? That's my question. I mean, is it possible?
Well, if Chris Nolan...
Surely we've covered everything.
If Chris Nolan wants to make another Batman film, that's absolutely fine. On the other hand, if Joel Schumacher's thinking about it, I would strongly advise against.
Madagascar, number 5?
It's, you know, perfectly fine. It's jolly, and my kids really, really loved it, and now my two kids spend the whole day singing, I like to move it, move it. So clearly, for its target audience, it's great.
Jason?
I got to go to the movies.
You have. You got to stop being in them. Herbie Fully Loaded at 4.
Okay, so I was away when it came out. So yesterday I took my kids to see it at the 11 o'clock performance in Southampton. And I'm really not making this up. I was in floods of tears. And I was sitting there thinking...
Yeah,
I cried
everything.
I know. But I was... I know, obviously, it's 42-year-old man nostalgia for Herbie movies. And I like Lindsay Lohan anyway. And I like the thrust of the movie. Although it's obviously creaky and cronky and all over the place. But I was literally crying bawling my eyes out. I thought it was just really sweet and stupid.
I don't think Jason will have seen this one.
I don't, but no. I'll speak on behalf of my niece who loved it.
Yeah, well, there you go, you see. Yeah.
Crash is at 3?
You know, I love the David Cronenberg Crash. I really like the Paul Haggis Crash. I think they're two sides of the same coin. And I think that it's really unfortunate that some British critics have been incredibly sniffy about this, because it's a very fine, independently spirited piece of work that deals with religion and philosophy and does it in an intelligent, sensitive way. And incidentally, Matt Dillon is fabulous in it. And incidentally, Matt Dillon is really good in Herbie Fully Loaded.
Jason Biggs, do you see that one?
I have not, but Paul Haggis is... I'm a real fan, and I'm upset and disappointed in myself that I'm yet to go see this movie.
Okay, The Island at number 2.
You know, it's a multi-million dollar remake of The Cloners Project, except it isn't. I mean, that's the weird thing. Michael Bay spends $130 million making this movie, and then it is clearly The Cloners Project, but apparently it's not, and now there's some sort of legal issue. I mean, The Cloners Project, or The Cloners Horror, I think it was called in America, cost $350,000 to make and does everything that this does. It's not terrible. It's not Pearl Harbor. It's not the worst movie ever. It's not nothing like as bad as the reviews say, but it's way too long. It should be 89 minutes long. It's the Cloners Horror.
Jason, you missed this one?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Charlie? But
Michael Bay may ring him up tomorrow and say, if he want to be in a movie, it's not going to work if he's just said, yeah, I saw it and it stank.
No, I didn't say that. Yeah, well, that's true. That's true as well. But no, I really didn't see it. I'm out of the loop.
Okay, we got one more. You got one more to redeem yourself. And if you haven't seen this one, think of something profound to say.
Drum roll, please.
UK's number one is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mark Kermode.
Loved it. Took the kids. Loved it. They loved the original, obviously, as well. But this, I thought, was fantastic. My only criticism would be that I don't think the songs are... Mm-hmm. I'm a big Danny Elfman fan, but I don't think the songs are quite as good as the songs in the original screen adaptation of it. But I thought that stylistically it was marvellous. I thought Johnny Depp's performance was really terrific and really, you know, back on form after, let's face it, the Horrors of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Stop that.
No, I'm not going to stop it. That's a terrible, stinky film, and he should have known better. But this is great, and I thought it was really terrific, and I want to go and see it again straight away.
Jason, did you manage to see Charlie and the Chocolate?
I did see it.
Oh.
thank God. And I, too, loved it. And you know what? The songs were, I think, the weak... And actually, it wasn't even so much the songs as much as it was the choreography. I didn't really like those sort of... The dance sequences. I wasn't a really huge fan.
Yeah.
The Oompa Loompa stuff from the first movie I thought was much better. But I thought Johnny Depp was fantastic. I'd pay just to go see him walk into the glass elevator again. I thought it was great.
Jason, I realise you weren't exactly prepared for our top 10 review, but I appreciate you hanging on longer than you were supposed to be with us today. And all the best for Guy X.
And Michael Bay's on the phone.
Tell him I'm running to see his movie right now. I can't talk.
Jason Biggs, appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. That's Jason Biggs, obviously.
Obviously.
Who's in Guy X, which is opening next week.
Next week, I think.
Okay.
Yes.
Don't forget, if you ever, for whatever reason, miss the reviews, it's all downloadable. Go via the website and it can be part of your MP3 experience, and you can carry us around in your back pocket.
Number 3 in the charts at the moment, I believe.
Is it 3? It's gone up. Excellent. Tim Spurrier says, I usually agree with Mark's judgment on films, but with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I couldn't disagree more. A great story and visually stunning, but completely ruined by the Americanisms, candy and dollars and that kind of thing. Obviously, Americans have no idea that there's an original English language. Willy Wonka, born and brought up in England with English parents, yet turns out to be an American chat show host. Way off track by both Depp and Burton, who I'm normally a fan of. The film is rescued by some great touches, but on the whole, a massive disappointment.
You know, I know some people have said this about the Americanisms. They didn't bother me. They really didn't bother me. And I mean, in the past, those sort of things have done, but this didn't bother me. I thought that it... Because the thing with Tim Burton movies is they exist in a netherworld anyway. They exist in a kind of Grimm's fairy tale environment. And so that sort of stuff, it didn't bother me. I know other people have complained about it, but I just thought it was visually fantastic, and maybe that was what carried me along, and I laughed all the way through. And every time there was a scene, I thought, I want to watch this again, because there's much more going on in this scene than I'm able to take in on the first viewing.
This from Martin in Old Portsmouth. Simon, if you read this out, don't let Mark interrupt. Turn his microphone off or something. Last week, Phil Williams and Mark became involved in a discussion regarding the pronunciation of Scarlett Johansson's name.
Johansson.
Phil was going for the soft Johansson option, whilst Mark claimed... you're not allowed to interrupt,
sorry,
Junis,
just saying it's right.
Mark claimed, typically somewhat stridently, that the hard Johansson was the correct pronunciation, then put his fingers in his ears and went, la, 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 I'm right, you're wrong, not listening anymore, as he does. What I'm about to write pains me greatly. Indeed, as my fingers sit poised over the keyboard, my soul cries out in anguish. My skin crawls, my teeth itch. Demons rake their fingernails across my scalp. Harpies wail in torment around me, and the smell of brimstone fills my nostrils.
Go on.
But I must be strong. Here goes. Mark Kermode is right.
I know.
And then he puts G-A-A-A-A-H-H-H-H, capital letters,
I told
and exclamation
you.
Marks. Don't interrupt. I hope I don't have to do that again for a while. Why is he right? Let me tell you. Were Scarlett to have been Scandinavian, he would be wrong. But she is American.
She's not.
American English anglicises the pronunciation of European surnames in the interest of simplicity. So, yes, Mark is right for once, but The Exorcist still isn't scary, and Elvis died on the toilet wearing a nappy. So,
that's
so
cheap.
That's the correspondence on that one's over and done with, I suspect. Movies out this week include Bewitched.
Why is it that all these TV shows are turning up as big screen movies? I mean, you know, we had Starsky and Hutch last year. It's perfectly fine, although the whole gag about Starsky and Hutch was it was taking the mickey out of Starsky and Hutch at the same time as, you know, milking it for all it's worth. If you look back into the past, we had things like The Brady Bunch, which I actually rather like, but it was that was, you know, a very sort of postmodern take on, you know, The Brady Bunch is all rubbish 70s TV show, but let's put them into the present day and see what we can do with them. And now coming up, Dukes of Hazzard, which I haven't seen yet. Dukes of Hazzard opens next week. But I have to confess that I was never a fan of the Dukes of Hazzard TV show. And you know, I am not overly optimistic that the film is going to retrieve the ground of that. Anyway, in the meantime, Bewitched, which was a 1960s hit witchy marital sitcom about a guy who marries a witch. And she's trying not to be witchy. She's trying to, you know, get on with her domestic situation. But of course, whenever she wants anything done, she just wiggles her nose. And if we had a sound effect now, it goes tickle, tickle, tickle. You know, she, it's Elizabeth Montgomery.
Loved it. It was great.
Fine. Okay. So... Now, big screen version, directed and written and directed by Nora Ephron. Nora Ephron, who wrote When Harry Met Sally, directed Sleepless in Seattle, and for my money, has always been a much better writer than director. The producers say that one of the reasons that Nicole Kidman landed the part of the modern-day lead in this is because of the, and I quote, miraculous similarity of her nose to that of Elizabeth Montgomery. So, having, you know, won an Oscar for basically sticking that prosthetic stonk on the end of, you know, on The Hours. Remember that film, The Hours? You know,
yeah,
with Richard, and she walked around being very mopey for like 10 minutes and won an Oscar because everyone went, oh, Nicole has stuck on an artificial nose. She must be Marlon Brando. Let's give her a gong. So now it's her own nose. And this is a postmodern version of Bewitched in which the story is she plays a real life witch who is trying to turn her back on her witchy past, who is signed up to play the lead in, guess what? A remake of the television series Bewitched.
Oh, dear.
Be still, my aching sides. Will Ferrell is the Ferrell. How do you pronounce it? Is it Ferrell or Ferrell?
Ferrell.
Johansson. Will Johansson,
it's
as
Ferrell.
I'm going to call it. Is it Ferrell?
Yeah.
Have you met him?
It's Ferrell.
Fine. Will Ferrell is the washed-up actor who is going to star as Darren, who basically casts Nicole Kidman because she's a nobody and because he wants to shine in the TV show, not realising, of course, that it's Nicole Kidman, so that's not going to happen. Anyway, weird, magical japes ensue. I think we'll probably end up reviewing it after the news, but let's hear a clip before we go in, just so that you can hear some of the perky, pesky...
Can I just say, the clip, before you introduce the clip...
You know where
apparently,
it's coming.
No, apparently the Southampton transmitter is due to go off the air in about a minute's time for a couple of hours of engineering work. So this means your entire family won't be able to hear you from
now on. Are you serious?
Yeah, the Southampton transmitter is about to go. We apologise for that. It's essential engineering works. Very sorry. Listen to the internet or something, or just move to Surrey or something like that. Anyway, off you go.
But if Southampton's not listening, there's really no point. Well, look, it's not terrible, but it's not any good either. There are many faults with it. One of them is that Will Ferrell... Ferrell?
Yes.
Fine. Okay. Will Ferrell has basically two modes. One of them is the mode that he uses in the Woody Allen movie, in which he sort of, you know, does kind of urbane comedy. And the other is the one that he does in most other movies, in which he's like, gurning, flapping, you know, waving his arms, face and head and teeth and hair around all the time. And for some reason, in Bewitched, which is basically an urbane comedy, he's doing the mode. So he's like literally, Nicole Kidman is standing on screen and he is just, you know, chasing around, flapping everything. And you feel like saying, please, you know, drink less caffeine, just sit down and calm down a little bit. Nicole Kidman...
Like you're one to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, but I'm not a movie star, clearly. I mean, this is my job. His job is to play Darren. And he's not playing Darren. He's playing the lead character out of Elf. That's the main problem. He just happens to be on set as Darren. The other problems with it are Nicole Kidman, she just doesn't have the Elizabeth Montgomery magic in this role. In fact, Nicole Kidman isn't great at comedy. If you look back to something like To Die For, in in which it's jet black satire. I think she's absolutely brilliant. And she's great in Moulin Rouge, which I like very much, although people are sniffy about it. But if you look at this and the recent remake of The Stepford Wives, which was honkingly dreadful stuff, she just isn't very funny. I mean, she just isn't somebody who manages to hit. I mean, we were talking to Jason Biggs earlier on. He has a much better sense of comic timing than Nicole Kidman does. The wiggling of the nose, incidentally, sorry, not great. She doesn't wiggle her nose. She wiggles the whole of the bottom of her face. And the point about the nose wiggling is it's the nose that gets wiggled. It's not the whole jaw. So
a bit of a Montgomery purist.
It is a bit. I am a bit. I mean, I'm not a great fan of Bewitched, but it's just if you're going to pay this kind of homage to it, that sort of stuff becomes important. The other thing is, as a director, as I said before, I don't think Nora Ephron really understands when exactly to cut and when not to belabor a joke. So we have performances by Shirley MacLaine and Michael Caine, who are sort of rolled on as, you know, the old school thesps to do all these gags, which really don't work very well because they're not orchestrated very well. You have the standard Nora Ephron problem of just simply plastering jukebox things all over the soundtrack. You know, every single witchy themed crooner classic comes up, and one horrendous moment in which they butcher a few bars of The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again. And you do not use Won't Get Fooled Again lightly. You know, Michael Moore famously wanted to use the end Fahrenheit with Pete Townsend and said no, and good for him for doing so. He didn't say no, so that you could get all the bottom stuck in the middle of Bewitched, and my toes curled so far up they were coming back my ears. It's not awful. It's just not very good. And my advice would be, you know, if Rob Martin handled the action, it would have been a different film. Maybe if Will Ferrell hadn't shouted and screamed and flapped around so much, it would have been a better film.
Not to get your poster, is it?
No. I mean, it's, you know, it's not awful is the best you can say.
James in Southampton says, hi, Simon and Mark. Enjoying the programme. Just wondering which transmitter's been switched off, because I live in Southampton. I can still hear you at the moment. So
there we go. He's probably picking up from Basingstoke.
Maybe just a bit tardy in their switching off.
Yes.
Patrick, about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
Says Simon, in respect to this film, the original film feels like it's in Northern Europe, not Britain. Belgium, perhaps, because of the chocolate. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, vaguely. I mean, it's, you know, Gene Wilder in the lead, I think. But it is specifically nowhere. That's the thing.
From Matthew. Having listened to the wise words of Kermode last week, on Monday I went to see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with a friend of mine. A wonderful and funny film with an excellent performance from Johnny Depp. Thank you, Mark.
Well done. Well done.
This... from Bobby says, now I know what was wrong with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. There were no good-looking orcs, with reference to the Oompa Loompa while back. Dr. Brian says, does Dr. Mark not think that Gene Wilder's performance as Willy Wonka was a much more subtle and sinister version than Johnny Depp?
I don't think it was more sinister, but I think it was a very good performance. And in fact, to Johnny Depp's credit, he has said, you know, look, I love the Gene Wilder performance, and I very specifically went a completely different way. I mean, as James King said when I was off and he reviewed it, it is obvious that what he's doing to some extent is a kind of impression of Michael Jackson. It is that weird, you know, kid in a fairy tale environment who has, you know, very, very a strange and dark side that's kind of impenetrable. And I actually thought Johnny Depp's performance was very good. And one of the things that was good about it was that it in no way refers to the Gene Wilder performance. So they're very, very different films, and they both stand together.
Tim on this says, Roald Dahl, this is about Americanisms in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah. Roald Dahl used dollar in the original book of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I should know, I've just listened to a CD of him reading the book several times on a car trip south of France.
Know, that in that case would be entirely why it didn't stand out to me.
Adrian in Kent, of course Mark didn't mind the Americanisms in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. As his language is rife with them. He always uses the term bunch when an Englishman would more correctly use load. He also greeted you earlier, your earlier interviewee, with how you doing rather than doing.
Doing.
He would certainly understand the phrase all Burton's films are crocs, even if he would wrongly disagree.
Do you think I talk in Americanism?
I hadn't noticed.
I'm shocked and stunned.
And one more, unless you had too much of this last week, okay. Graham says, this is on the Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
I will bring this debate to an end. Yeah. Tom Wilkinson was on your programme a while back and said after Simon said Johansson, Tom corrected him by saying Johansson, as he had just worked with her on a film, and so she should know.
Exactly.
Nice one. Mark Kermode speaks the truth, according to Graham.
Yeah, and what I like about this is the level of surprise at that, you know, Kermode right shock.
I know.
Yeah, well, you know, we should all just wise up.
So, Bewitched, it's not great. It's not what great. Else is out?
There's an awful lot of attention from me and you and everyone we know, and we had the writer, director and star on the show last week, and this is an independently spirited Sundance favourite about the difficulties of relationships.
An independently spirited Sundance favourite? Can you speak in English?
Sundance Film Festival has for a long time been the home of independent film. It's set up by Robert Redford. It's out of the Sundance Sundance Ranch. And it's basically, it used to be a real home for genuinely independent film. Then in recent years, it's been kind of taken over somewhat by the sort of more production line independent end, which was characterized by Miramax films, you know, films which aren't really that independent. Now, me and you and everyone we know is kind of a return to the great, if perhaps not so great, days of independent filmmaking, when independent meant quirky, offbeat, weird, kooky, zany, cute, all those things. It's a film about a series of relationships, the central one being between Miranda July, who herself was a performance artist, playing a performance artist, and a shoe salesman, and their inability to speak the language of love in a way that both of them understand. Meanwhile, around this are spiraling a whole bunch of other... Incidentally, Terry Gilliam was once flying an airplane over... He wasn't flying it. He was in an airplane that was flying over the sea, and he looked down, he said, look, a whole bunch of water. And if it's good enough for Terry Gilliam, it's good enough for me. A whole bunch of stories circling around this central romance, the edgiest of which involve very young children accessing the internet and talking in internet chat rooms in ways in which the children themselves don't really understand. And I have to say, I wasn't entirely happy about that stuff. And also about young adolescent girls learning about their dawning sexuality, I suppose, is the way it would be described. You see, the thing is, for me, there's a very thin line between wide-eyed innocent and slightly annoying. And it's a line which me and you and everyone we know treads pretty much all the way through. There's an absolutely lovely score, and I do like the soundscape of it. I think it's, you know, it's interesting to listen to. There were large sections of it in which I really was gripping the side of my chair thinking, if you don't stop quirking, I am really going to have to leave because my quirk tolerance is not that high. It has been hailed by many critics, including famously Roger Ebert in America, as a real, you know, triumph of independent filmmaking. And it is true that it is genuinely independent. I don't myself know that that's enough, but if you're looking for something that, you know, if you look in the if you look in an encyclopedia under the word offbeat, you'd find this, and that may be enough. For me, it wasn't.
Milo on this text says, Simon and Mark, it's the Land of the Dead premiere in Edinburgh tonight, like many quite disturbed folk, I've been waiting for years. Mark, is it any good?
Well, you know, the weird thing about it is, it's the fourth in the, you know, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Day of Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and now Land of the Dead. So it's the fourth in the trilogy, so now it's a quadrilogy or whatever it is. And George Romero, I think, is going to be on the show next week. It's very strange because, in a way, it's a modern movie, but it also could have been made almost the day after he finished doing Day of the Dead. Now, if you're, as I am, a big horror bore, Romero is like, you know, Orson Welles.
I'm not, by the way.
No, but I was saying if you were in the hypothetical
I'm
sense.
I'm just saying I'm not.
No, I know, but you're wrong. The most interesting thing about it is it's got a 15 certificate, which tells you a lot about the way things have changed, because it is a meaty zombie movie in the way of all those things. And because if, like me, you do hold the Dead trilogy very, very, you know, close to your heart, you know, it was lovely to watch. It is strangely dated, though. But I think, again, I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. It'd be interesting to see how much mainstream potential it has.
Tetralogy?
Apparently. Quadrilogy is what they called it when it was the Alien movies, but, you know, which, what do they know? They're Americans, right? George, a whole bunch of Dead movies.
George Romero is on next Friday when we're coming from Trent Bridge. So that's
he's a big cricketing fan, apparently.
That would be great. Take George Romero to Trent Bridge to watch The Ashes. That's an unmissable program already. 14 to 4. Bewitched, Me and You and Everyone We Know, a couple of the releases done. What else is new?
If you're actually looking for something that's offbeat and independent and strange in a good way, there's this very odd movie, Primer, which is it's been described as a sort of a modern take on the theories of 2001. It's a very, very strange, very low-budget film about two guys who are venture capitalists to some extent, and they're messing around inventing something. It looks like at the beginning they're like inventing a new refrigeration system, and it's shot in this kind of very handheld documentary style. And as they start experimenting with this thing, this refrigeration system that they've invented, they start discovering weird anomalies in the thing they've invented, and lo and behold, it turns out that they have invented a time machine. And it's a really, really bizarre film because they invent a time machine that can move them backwards 6 hours. And they therefore get into the time machine, And they, firstly, they go forward into the future to discover how stocks and shares are going to work out. But then they have to come back to their original time and then sit in a hotel room so that they don't meet themselves out there in the real world. So the whole doubles thing. Now, It's really weird. It's very, very low tech. It's very hard to follow. I mean, there are long sections of it in which the conversations are completely baffling. You can't understand exactly what's being said. And when you can, you can't figure it out anyway. But it's a really moody, really strange, very paranoid, actually kind of early 1970s paranoia feel to it. A science fiction movie with almost no real science in it and no special effects, all done as a kind of very strange, edgy, like I said, 1970s conspiracy movie type thriller. It sounds like it ought to be a total bodge, but actually it's really rather fascinating. I have to see it again to fully understand it. I mean, I came out of it and my head was really reeling. It was one of those ones in which the film expects you to step up to the mark, to really make some kind of effort to understand what's going on. And that is increasingly a rarity in mainstream cinema. So as I said, I think if you're looking for something that really is independently minded, Me and You and Everyone We Know is winning all the plaudits. But I thought Primer, well, it's not perfect. And to some extent, it has that kind of very, very low budget feel that you remember the one of the best things George Lucas ever did, which THX 1138, you know, before somebody gave him money and said, you know what you really need to do is go and make Star Wars, because actually everyone really likes those battle droids.
Because that's been a complete disaster for him, hasn't it?
It has. That's really really hasn't worked out for him. It reminded me to some extent of Darren Aronofsky's film Pi. It has that same
kind of,
because that was you were a big fan of that, weren't you? Do you want to just remind me of the plot?
No idea what you're talking about.
If you are not listening in Southampton, because presumably you can't hear me, but anyone else, if you liked Pi, the Darren Aronofsky film, then I guarantee you, you'll like Primer, although you may well come out feeling that your head has been completely rattled. But it's interesting. It's not perfect, but it's strange in a good way. I've stopped because you look like you're going to read some, but I can just plough straight on.
I'm just browsing through the correspondence. Okay. Again, you're impersonating the Southampton transmitter, and it's very off-putting.
Okay, can I move on to Unleashed in that
case? Could
you? Okay, so after the sort of the quizzical, strange, you know, mind meld of Primer, let's look at Unleashed. Unleashed, right, is the new Jet Li movie. And the story, I mean, the weird thing about this is Jet Li is a big martial arts action adventure star. He's a bit of an icon. You've heard of Jet Li, right?
Mm-hmm. Indeed, I have.
Fine. Now, apparently, this movie is set in Glasgow, although there's really very little evidence that that's where it's set, largely because all the characters in it are clearly East End gangsters. The lead East End gangster being played by Bob Hoskins. Now, Bob Hoskins is is a proper actor. He can act. You know, he's a proper professional thesp, okay? And one of the things that people now do with action movies is you get somebody like Jet Li, who perhaps isn't entirely at home as an English language actor, but is a great martial artist. So what you do is you stick him in a film with a bunch of other people who really can act, because they will do the acting and he will do the fighting stuff. So the story here is that Bob Hoskins is this gangland underworld guy who has basically turned Jet Li into his pet dog. And the film was originally called Danny the Dog, and he wears a collar. And Bob Hoskins goes around sorting out his gangland people, and whenever he wants somebody to get their head kicked in, he takes off the collar, and Jet Li goes, "Man, I've just finished off the whole wash, you twat!" Yun Wo Pei, you know, fantastic martial art. And then he puts the collar back on again. At the crucial point, he escapes because of his love of classical music, to which he is opened up by Morgan Freeman, who plays a piano tuner.
You're making this up.
I'm not in Glasgow. Now, OK, it's one of those things, OK? Now, on an absolute level, it is nonsense. It is absolute stupid nonsense. On the other hand, there is something strangely charming about a film in which there is a martial arts guy who is kept as a sort of, you know, this is the reference that kept being made, you know, he has been grown as somebody's, you know, attack dog, who then discovers his inner self because he hears a piece of piano music, which takes him back to an earlier time in which he has some kind of primordial memory of his mother, who it turns out was a musician who played classical music on a piano. I mean, you are sitting there with your jaw on the floor thinking, I would love to have seen the graph they did with the narrative arc of this film. And of course, every 5 minutes, there is just, you know, a head-pummeling action sequence in which your man Jet Li just bashes everybody to pieces. And it will be like Jet Li with no weapons and people armed with, you know, effectively dumper truck load of, you know, huge big pole axes and stuff. And of course, he always, because it's an action adventure movie, and that's what it is. And Bob Hoskins, his whole performance is just turned up to 11. It's just, it's not even words. It's just grunt. And you know the thing that he does when he kind of squats his head down, like he's got no neck at all, so that he does just look like this kind of great big ball of anger. And that's the level of the whole film. And I know that it's been given some one-star reviews and called, you know, yes, it's stupid. Yes, it's dumb. Yes, it's idiotic. Did I smile a little bit during it? I have to confess that I did. And you'd have to be fairly hard-hearted not to get any pleasure out of it at all.
On the subject of Americanisms, Sarah says, please, does Mark Kermode use Americanisms? No British person would say homage with that faux American respect to the French. I have to say, respect for the French is something you rarely
I've never been accused of that in the past.
Jay, here's another rather splendid name of Jay Thundercliff.
OK, so that's a good name.
It is. Can you ask the purveyor of pronunciation, what is the correct way to say Basinger, as in Kim? It's annoyed me for years. Basinger,
Basinger. Basinger, apparently. Hmm? Basinger, apparently, not with a hard G as opposed to a soft G. And the only reason I know this is because...
You're a film critic?
No, not because of that. And, of course, you know, I met her and she said I was charming. That's true. It's on tape. I mean, clearly, you know, she didn't know what she was talking about. But because it came up, there was a court case. Remember this? There was a court case when she was meant to be doing Boxing Helena, and then she didn't do Boxing Helena. For very good reasons. It is an absolutely toilet movie. But in court, her lawyer very pointedly corrected the mispronunciation of her name.
So it's Basinger.
I think so, but I may be misremembering this. I wouldn't, you know, go out to bat on it in the same way as I would about Scarlett Johansson.
And Brian in Kansas says, on the subject of Nicole Kidman being funny, I beg to differ. Nicole Kidman was exceedingly funny in Eyes Wide Shut. I've never laughed so hard.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
A piece of wood.
That is absolutely true. It's completely, you know, that movie to me is hugely overrated.
Tell me that the movie of the week is The Perfect Man, please.
Okay, Perfect Man. So here's the story. You know Heather Locklear?
Yes.
Okay, but you, glamorous.
Yes.
Fine.
Yes.
Heather Locklear is a single mum who moves from town to town constantly because she keeps getting dumped by men who will all turn out to be complete rubbish. She has a teenage daughter who decides that the way to stop her mum from moving from town to town constantly is to invent a fictional perfect man on the internet, which seems to be a recurring theme this week, and to send love emails to her, making her think that there is a perfect man out there in the town that they're in so she can stay in it. Shall we hear? Have we got time for a clip?
Yeah.
There must be something wrong with him.
Who?
Mr. Wonderful.
What? No, there's nothing wrong with him. He's perfect.
Then why all the secrecy? Why doesn't he just come on over, show his face, and say hello? Like a normal person.
Listen to yourself. The man wants to be the least bit romantic, and all of a sudden you think he's not normal.
How do I know if he is? And if he is, what does he look like? Is he tall? Is he short? Is he blonde curly hair, straight black hair, what?
But he has a big fat wart on his nose. I bet that he's really, really handsome.
Yeah, how would you know?
He writes like he's really handsome.
Honey, have you seen pictures of Shakespeare? Bald, skinny.
Does that even really matter?
Yes, because you can't have a relationship with a man you've never laid eyes on.
It's just so totally true, isn't it? It's just so, hey, and it's just a bunch of stuff, and it's rubbish.
Is Hilary Duff in it?
She is. Why is that a big deal?
A compulsory viewing in our house.
Why? Then. Explain to me the Hilary Duff, because I have to say, I watched this thing.
Who is Lizzie McGuire on television?
Is that why?
That's right.
You see,
she has a very, very considerable following.
I didn't know that. Okay, I just thought you're a rubbish actress, but it may be that you've just been given a rubbish script, and this is a really, really awful film, and, you know, quite beyond the fact of, you know, the problems that are meant to beset this single mum who's played by Heather Locklear. It's like, no, what dating problems is Heather Locklear meant to have, frankly? And why is it kind to send emails to your mother making up this man who basically comes across like a stalker? And do I care about any of these people, whether they move town tomorrow? And then I was sitting there trying to think my way into the sort of persona of, you know, a young teenager watching this who maybe I'd never heard of this Lizzie McGuire. There was a Lizzie McGuire movie.
Yeah,
right?
There was indeed.
It's her. Is it her?
It's exactly her.
Right, well, that was rubbish as well. And she's rubbish, and it's rubbish, and Heather Locklear is rubbish, and the whole thing is rubbish. And
you're never coming to our house.
Well, I'm really sorry, but if somebody has seen this film and likes it, please let me know why it is that The Perfect Man is acceptable.
OK, well, we can continue that conversation next week when your cricket education continues, because you've already been to Durham and we saw England...
With Mike Gatting.
Mike Gatting explained the rules of cricket and confused everybody.
He did.
Well, next week you're going to be at Trent Bridge for the first day of the next Ashes match.
The next Ashes match.
And Alex Stewart will... you missed them? Alex Stewart will be explaining the rules of cricket to you this time round.
And George Romero will be there.
And George Romero will be at the cricket. Now, that's something to look forward to. Have a great weekend. See you Monday at 1.